Hello and welcome to Overinvested, a podcast about pop culture obsessions. I'm Gavia Baker-Whitelaw and here is this week's co-host, Claire Biddles.
Hello.
This week we watched the blockbuster event of the year, Dune Part 2. Directed by Denis Villeneuve, this sci-fi epic adapts the second half of Frank Herbert's novel Dune, starring Timothée Chalamet as the messianic leader Paul Atreides, Rebecca Ferguson as his ambitious and manipulative mother Jessica, and Zendaya as Chani, a warrior from the Fremen culture of the planet Arrakis. So if you've not listened to it before, we have an episode on the first Dune from a few years ago with Morgan, so check that out. Some of our commentary will carry over to this one, I think, but there's a lot to chew on in this film, which is colossally successful. It seems like there's so much more conversation around this one, and then I was like, oh, it's because it's not the early months of the pandemic and everyone is now going to theatres. So it's like everyone is fucking obsessed and the discourse levels on the internet have reached unbearable heights already.
Unbearable. When was the first, was the
2021,
first one,
and it was when HBO and Warner Brothers were like releasing stuff simultaneously on HBO Max.
Yeah, I watched it in the cinema, but I think it was like one of those times where it was still like really spread out.
And this one was delayed for ages, and it's now very obvious why, because it has the best press tour of all time with hottest actors in the world, like the cool generation. Everyone's like, oh, it's the new generation of movie stars, and I'm like, for once you're right, because it's Timothy, it's Florence Pugh, Zendaya, and Austin Butler, Elvis himself, who has a banger of a role in this film.
Oh my god, we'll get into that for sure.
So to kind of introduce this film, I feel like Denis Villeneuve needs no introduction. He is one of the very small number of serious blockbuster directors of his generation right now. I say younger, he's middle-aged, he has adult children, but like, you know, you've got the old guard like Spielberg, and then you've got the people like Christopher Nolan, and then you've got this massive number of Gen X kind of hacks who are doing a lot of Marvel stuff. but Denis, you know, he did Blade Runner 2049, which wasn't to my taste, but many people admire, and Sicario, and obviously the Dune franchise is like his massive passion project. He is a huge Dune nerd, as are many of the people involved in this film, including my nemesis Hans Zimmer, composer. We'll get into it.
When I heard those first strains of the score, I was like, there he is again. Gabby is nemesis.
Yeah, so much to, yeah. And obviously, I think you're all familiar with the concept of Timothée Chalamet and Zendaya. We've covered several Timothée films in the past. Claire is our expert, and obviously Zendaya, megastar. But yeah, to kind of talk about like what the film is actually about, this film is basically kind of like a subversion of the Chosen One narrative. Like the first film sets up Paul Atreides in a story that you can definitely enjoy as a fairly traditional, albeit rather morally ambiguous style of coming of age, chosen one, like hero's journey story. So it's like, you know, his father is killed by a disgusting enemy and he is thrown out of his home as it's colonized. And then he's got all these impressive powers. Like, it's like, oh, you're the unique chosen one because, you know, you've been bred through decades of weird witch eugenics scheming. But like, you can watch that film and be like, yes, this is a coming of age story and he's the hero. And this was like part of Denis Villeneuve's mission narratively with these two films, is to really hammer home the extremely obvious fact that Paul Atreides is a bad dude who does bad stuff. And by splitting the book into two halves, you have much more of an obvious rise and fall arc. There's this quote from Villeneuve that I just want to start out with, because I think it basically sets out his entire goal very succinctly. It was in this very fun interview he did with the New York Times, where he and Timothée Chalamet are just like giggling together and talking French together, because Villeneuve is French-Canadian and Timothée Chalamet has dual citizenship. So it's very fun. But he said, Frank Herbert wanted the book to be a cautionary tale, a warning against charismatic religious leaders. He felt that he failed because people misperceived his intentions. So he wrote Dune Messiah, which is the second book in the series, an epilogue where he made sure his ideas would be seen. I think the movie is more tragic and more dramatic than the book because it's closer to Frank's intentions. So I'm not like a Dune head, but I do live with a Dune head. So I've been given a lot of insight. You know, whenever I hear an audiobook in the house, there is like a 50-50 chance it will either be one of the Dune novels or the Silmarillion. So there's a lot of lore just floating in the air with my house. But yeah, so this film, it's really more sci-fi fantasy than straight sci-fi, because the world building is very much around warring feudal houses eugenics mm-hmm. and a setting that doesn't have any computer technology. So a lot of people kind of talk about how Star Wars is a ripoff of Dune, which it is. I say this affectionately. But Game of Thrones is also drawing a lot from Dune because it's got all this stuff to do with, you know, the genetic lineage of various aristocratic families. So Paul was like intentionally bred from the Atreides line, and his mother Jessica is this concubine who belongs to the Bene Gesserit witch squad, and her job was to like produce this perfect child. And the problem is that he turned out to be a boy and what they wanted was a girl. And the magical thing about him is that he has girl powers, and that is one of the many absurd foundation stones of this incredible story. But yeah, this film, I have to say, I'm incredibly impressed with it on a technical level, as are almost all viewers. But I'm just not that invested in the characters. Like, it doesn't stir much in me. What do you think? What was your reaction?
I'm kind of on the same kind of level as you with that. Like, there were certain bits that would just looked so incredible that I wanted to, like, stand up and applaud. And I'm really not a big blockbustery type person usually, but I really like these two films. I think about the big epic fantasy sagas that I am invested in, which is probably only Star Wars.
Do you like Lord of the Rings?
I'm not that bothered. I'll watch it, but...
Because I thought you might have liked it because it's got so many, like, weeping men in
it.
But on the other hand, you're not much of a sentimentalist, whereas I'm happy to embrace high-quality sentimentalism, which is very much Lord of the Rings.
yeah. Lord of the Rings is a funny one because I don't really fancy any of the boys in Lord of the Rings because they're either like too manly or like dressed to be effeminate in a like unconvincing way. Whereas in Dune, you've got perfect Timothy Chalamet. But I rewatched all of Star Wars like fairly recently, and like the thing that struck me with that rewatch was how much I am invested in the characters, because like obviously the characterization and the script at its best is really great. But with this one, I'm just surprised thinking about it because I'm not really invested in the characters, or definitely not the central relationship really. Like, I can kind of go along with it, but I'm not that bothered. But it's the only thing I can think of where I am carried along by how impressed I am by how it's done technically. You know, I don't know, it must be really good if
yeah, it's just odd. Like... I mean, we definitely are going to have a lot to talk about with the technical stuff. I mean,
yeah,
to me, like, having listened to what you're saying there, it just makes me think about how I feel like a sense of detachment from the experience and the text itself, because when I'm looking at the way real Dune heads are talking about this movie and are in many cases just having the time of their lives, I'm like, I can see a world where I also am obsessed with this because I love lore, I love like nerdy shit, there's a lot of really interesting concepts happening, and you could obviously recognize very easily what's happening thematically in this film, which is why so much of the discourse is people condescendingly being like, I can't believe idiots aren't understanding what's going on. And it's like, maybe they dislike the film for other reasons, but who's to say?
Yeah, I only really realised what the witchy thing, what are they
called? Bene Gesserit.
I only really realised what that was like halfway through this film. I was like, oh yeah, that's what they are. But that was fine.
Yeah, it didn't one can matter. Just be swept away.
I do like the David Lynch Dune, but... you don't have to understand what's going on to understand the David Lynch Dune. Even more than this one, I'd say. I can see why Dune heads are really, like you say, having the time of their lives. But for the rest of us, it's just like bright lights and shiny
There's like really a unique skill set to make objects look really convincingly, terrifyingly enormous.
Right.
In a way that actually like made me think a little bit about kind of silent film epics, where they really would just either build like the biggest building you've ever seen in your life, or it would be really clever miniatures or something like that. But with this, I do feel this detachment between comprehending the themes and appreciating what's happening visually and auditorily. Like, there's some amazing sound design in this. And, like, the action scenes are completely stunning. But like you said, I don't really care about the central relationship because it isn't structured in a way that's, like, interesting as a romance. And I think Chani's characterization is somewhat lacking.
Yeah, absolutely.
But also, when I think about even beyond Star Wars, because, like, tonally, Star Wars isn't really a good comparison. I think Mad Max Fury Road is a good comparison, right? Because, like, that is so political, but also entertainment, but, like, all of it is visual spectacle, and it's so technically complicated. And obviously, they're both, like, sand movies. And with Mad Max, like, I've seen that film, like, four times, and every time I was like, oh my god, I'm dying right now, and I love it, and, like, every character is so fun to me, so...
Gav, do you want to hear something crazy?
Please hit me up.
I've never seen Mad Max.
That's incredible.
I've wanted to, but I just haven't, the moment hasn't struck me.
When you do eventually get around to that, I'm very curious what your reaction is, because I feel like the hype levels are just like beyond the pale at this point.
I think that's it. Like, I'm also like extremely contrary. So if somebody's like telling me to do something, I'm like, as if. And then I watch it like 15 years later and I'm like, guys, I don't know if you've heard about this film, Mad Max Fury Road.
It's very funny following you in Letterboxd because you're so happy to give something like a 1-star review. And I'm so wishy-washy. I'm like, well, I mean, they did really remember their dialogue. Those sweethearts.
They can operate a camera. Yeah. And I can't do that.
Far too forgiving. Yeah, so let's get stuck into this movie, which has an, I said, absolutely amazing ensemble cast. Austin Butler is playing the most villainous of the villains, which is Feyd Rautha Harkonnen. For this, he is giving himself a Swedish accent because the film has decided that the Harkonnens are Swedish because Daddy Harkonnen is played by Stellan Skarsgård, which I enjoy tremendously. And then you have the Emperor of the Known Universe, played by Christopher Walken, and his daughter, the Princess Irulan. It's this situation where, because of the structure of the story, those two characters are basically siloed on the other side of the galaxy for almost all of the film, because you've got to have them there, but like they can only come in at the end, sort of the way that like Zendaya is barely in the first movie. But that's what happens when you adapt an epic with like millions of characters. And then Lea Seydoux plays Margot, who is like a young, seductive member of the Bene Gesserit, whose job is to...
She's
fucking great. Amazing casting. Her job is to like seduce Feyd Rautha. And there's this amazing scene that's mirroring one of the earlier scenes in the first Dune, where like the Bene Gesserit have this test that they give to young people. They give it to Paul Atreides. And like you put your hand in this magic box and it tortures your hand. And it's to like test whether you can withstand the torment. And then after Lea Seydoux has done this with Feyd Rautha, who is described in the text as psychotic and is this like comical kind of BDSM sadist, she basically tells her bosses, who are like the elder nuns of the Bene Gesserit, she's like, he kind of enjoyed it. Which is like absolutely hilarious scene where she's like, they couch it in much more kind of academic terms where it's like, he seems to get a certain pleasure from discomfort or some shit like that. And it's like, he definitely got a boner while putting himself in the torture box.
Got a boner while putting him in the torture box and then knocked her up.
There's a lot of really amazing eugenic stuff, which is going to pay off in a wild way in the next film. Oh, and also there's Stilgar, who is the... Javier Bardem's character, who is like one of the showiest characters in the film. He's kind of the funny character, but he's playing a religious extremist. He's doing an absolutely bonkers accent. There's a lot happening there.
I really liked how in this film, like the kind of new characters that were introduced, a lot of them kind of got on Javier Bardem's level in terms of wild performances. I mean, it's always the joke, isn't it? How like the central guy is like, is the least interesting. It's like, he's a guy called Paul. But now that a lot of these other characters have been introduced, there's a lot of freaks on board, which is really great. And Rebecca Ferguson ups her freak performance.
I'm obsessed with her. I'm completely obsessed. I have been watching so many interview clips with her. She is like the most compellingly weird, confident, hilarious person. She's like so sexy and fun. There's honestly no one doing it like Rebecca. But yeah, in this one, like she gets this role stirring up the religious extremists. But now I've jogged you, the listeners, memories of our ensemble cast. Let's talk about the themes of this film, which are bountiful and conflicted.
Yeah, very, very conflicted.
So this is a story about manipulating religious extremism for your own ends. As far as I can tell, Denis Villeneuve and his co-writer John Spates do some switching up with the world building and the order of the narrative from the book. But the basic situation here is that Paul and his mother, after having their home destroyed and their colonial base taken over by their enemies, the Harkonnens, they are now in the deserts of Arrakis with the Fremen people, who are very clearly modelled off Bedouin people in this film. And they decide that they are going to learn the ways of the Fremen to survive the desert and find some kind of foothold to overthrow the Harkonnens and regain their power over the planet. And initially, Jessica is far more cynical about this than Paul. Like, Paul presents himself as someone who really wants to be equal with the Fremen. He's very authentic and wanting to learn their ways. And he, of course, falls in love with Chani. and they have this relationship that's like, it's very kind of naturalistic. A lot of people have remarked upon the acting and accent choices in this film because Chani has Zendaya's normal American accent. Timothy has his own normal American accent. And Zendaya is kind of giving this performance that's quite modern and casual. That's not a critique. This would not be happening if it wasn't intentional. But it's definitely one of those genre movies where different characters feel like they're in different films in a very intentional way. So, you know, you've got total histrionics coming from Austin Butler, and Rebecca Ferguson also is giving this really extreme performance. And then Javier Bardem is just like off the fucking wall. And the contrast between Zendaya and Javier Bardem is very wild because they're both interacting with each other so much and are kind of from approximately the same cultural background. And there's one point where they kind of name drop the idea that Javier Bardem is from the quote-unquote South, and that like explains his whole vibe and his accent.
Oh, yeah,
and it's like,
really,
you're piling a lot of information into like that one line.
When she's like, he's from the South, could you not tell by his voice? I thought that was like really funny when they said that. I was like, I can't tell by anybody's accent where anybody's from.
Yeah, it's like a chaotic mix of different accents. And the whole situation with there being this like more religiously intense community in the South is something they made up for the film and the film's religious world building. And this whole franchise has this really interesting relationship with ideas of faith and kind of false prophecy and that sort of thing, because obviously the central story is that Paul Atreides builds himself up to be this prophetic figure among the Fremen. They have this prophecy about an off-worlder who can see the future and has all these powers will come to save the planet and like bring water back to Arrakis and let the Fremen take over. And he obviously fits the bill. He's already starting to have precognitive visions, which is something that only Bene Gesserit women should be able to have. And also, like, he's this great warrior and stuff. And it's this classic kind of white savior hero's journey intentionally that then deconstructs the white savior narrative later. And there's some like clangingly obvious commentary about this with him and Chani, where like he's learning stuff from Chani, like how to survive in the desert, rope a sandworm or whatever. And he's like, oh, I read about this in the anthropological text. And she's like, what? Just a very, very modern sort of like joke about that concept. But then in the sort of deeper, more spiritual sense, we see the kind of dreamlike elements and nightmare elements of the future that he starts to see, which is he gets nightmares of this massive kind of intergalactic famine and war that kills billions of people if he does decide to adopt this identity as the Mahdi, the prophet of the Fremen. Meanwhile, his mother is like, well, if we want to have an army of Fremen to kill the Harkonnens, then I'd better like start going on the campaign trail. So she is like fully embedding herself in, and she goes and replaces the current Reverend Mother, who's this very old woman, who's like the religious leader of this Fremen compound. And that involves drinking a bunch of blue sandworm juice, which makes her, it expands her mind, because Frank Herbert was of the LSD generation. Key element of all of this lore. And this means that like she...
That doesn't surprise
Yeah, it's
me,
like
actually.
Unsurprisingly, yeah. This was like a big...
It's like, all right.
This
yeah.
is a big psychedelic fave, which was kind of the foundation of the movie that wasn't made of this, which was going to star Salvador Dali as the emperor. The Alejandro Jodorowsky's Dune movie, which has a very fun documentary about this movie that never existed. Full of talking heads that are very much up their own arse in a very amusing way. But yeah, she like kind of sets herself up as the religious leader. And one of the many things that's kind of been talked about with this film, obviously, that we talked about in the last podcast as well, is its relationship with kind of coded Middle Eastern imagery, costumes, music, the concept of cultural appropriation, and the extensive Islamic world building that was in the original book. And because this movie is so popular and because there's so many kind of divergent opinions on the world building, there's a lot of very vocal pushback against people who are kind of criticizing the politics of the movie and people being like, well, you don't understand, it's all intentional. And it's like, it's all intentional, but it is genuinely complicated, not in the sense where people are like, oh, it's a complicated issue to try and like talk down something that's bad, but it's like, there's this kind of recursive, like snake eating its own tail situation with the decisions that are made creatively, because it is more complicated than just saying the casting in this movie is racist, which is something you can say very easily for like a Disney remake or something, you know? Because you can't just be like, well, we need to have an international cast for everyone in this movie because the Fremen are clearly coded to be Middle Eastern or North African, they have all this like Islamic imagery and language that's clearly based on Arabic and that sort of stuff. And the whole story is about them becoming an army of religious extremists who go on what is literally referred to as jihad in the book. And it's all tied up in kind of commentary on colonization. And like, from a modern perspective, it all reads as stuff like, oh, here's the Americans and the white people and the Europeans coming to steal the oil from the Middle East. Although in this case, it's like spice drugs. So you can't just be like, oh, the casting's a problem. And it is all intentional, but it's also a colossal mess. And when I watch this, and I know when a lot of other people watch this too, it's just like, okay, well, there's a lot happening here that's highly dubious. And it's simultaneously poorly thought out and like very intentional, because I have a few quotes from the high volume of criticism that's been written about this, particularly from writers of Middle Eastern descent and like Muslim writers. Roxana Hadidi at Vulture has written about both of these movies quite a lot. And she makes this point in one of the comments she says about like Dune 2 and its ending. She says, although part two invents regional and generational differences among the Fremen when it comes to the Lisan al-Ghaib prophecy, the details in Herbert's book that help us understand who the Fremen are outside of that divination are again absent here. No mention of the mishmish, which is Arabic for apricot, or baklava, on which the Fremen feast after Ramadan fasting, the importance of Hajj or religious pilgrimage, the Reverend Mother's memories of her Sunni ancestors and what they endured. And she also on Twitter linked to this quote from the person who was doing the constructed language for the movie, because the Fremen obviously have like their own language or languages which are occasionally spoken, which also is like big question marks about Chani's accent. But the problem is that like this whole franchise is set 10,000 years in the actual future. So it's not in an alternate world. So all of the linguistic choices are meant to be genuinely coming from Earth's languages and religious references, whereas the movie tries quite hard to divorce itself from actually referencing Islam. I will link to this in the show notes, but it's this article that Roxana Hadidi linked to, which is kind of talking about 20,000 years later, not a shred of Arabic is meant to still exist in Denis Villeneuve's movies. But at the same time, there's terms like Shai Halud and Lisan al-Ghaib, which is the terms for the sandworms and the prophet, which are meant to have just like magically kind of reappeared in culture, which is very much the same vibe that you get from the music. Because last time round, I wrote this like big feature article that was all about the music and how it had these very orientalist overtones. Or in fact, it is just straightforwardly orientalist in that the instruments that it uses are instruments that are used in American media to refer to the Middle East. And they're very exoticized. And this is what Hans Zimmer employs like throughout. There's the kind of the ululating singing, all done by this white singer who like has specialized in this style.
Oh my God, really?
Yeah, it's a white singer.
Holy shit.
And the way that they talk about the music is, oh, this is this alien music that we've created specifically for the setting. Because they can't, for PR purposes, say, I've selected the same instruments that I use in literal movies set in the Middle East to refer to specific cultures. Instead, it's like, I've made up alien music and it just coincidentally sounds like every person is going to listen to it with their brain, and their brain is going to tell them this is set in Iran, because that's like every war movie is like, bring in like the duduk, you know? It's all in like a fucking duduk. It's so kind of obvious what's happening, but like they're not allowed to mention that. They're not allowed to like explicitly say, oh yeah, this is Arab world building.
It's just really transparent. Not just sort of in generally about what you said about obviously the parts of the story parallel it and parts of the setting parallel it. But even stuff like the, if you're looking at other kind of craft elements, as well as the music, there's the face tattoos that Paul's mother gets when she becomes the Reverend Mother. And that's the characters that are kind of suggestive of Arabic, but not quite. And it's becomes like this kind of diluted version of it, where like you say, everybody who's looking at it and listening to it has already built up this whole like lifetime of, you know, suggestions, so we know what it is. And the costumes and
stuff. So this is like the problem, right? Because it's like that thing is like incredibly intentional, because like one of the things that people have really been kind of arguing online about is specifically like the imagery they use for Rebecca Ferguson, right? Because it's like, of course, the whole purpose of her role is that she is this malevolent white colonial figure who comes in and intentionally adopts the costuming and religious role of someone from a completely different culture in order to manipulate a prophecy, which the Bene Gesserit have in fact seeded in this culture like centuries before. So it's like, it's not like the movie is doing cultural appropriation, like the character is intentionally doing cultural appropriation.
Yeah.
But so it's like, it's but not like they're
the
unaware of it.
The culture is like diluted
yeah,
and
exactly.
weird and everybody knows what it is
yeah,
anyway.
They don't like, elaborate.
Say it with your chest.
Exactly.
You know?
They don't really elaborate on who the Fremen are outside of their utility to Paul and their religion and their survival techniques. So you don't see a lot of civilian and kind of day-to-day life. And the religious stuff is played very strongly for laughs by the Stilgar character, played by Javier Bardem, who is really funny because, like, he's a great actor. But it's like all of the religious stuff is played either for violence or comedy with them. And then the more spiritual elements are centering around Paul and Jessica. I've just remembered another really good quote, actually, which I should also include because there's so much good writing in this. So there's this film critic named Siddhant Adlaka who was writing for this website called Joy Sauce. And he kind of talks about the language and is talking about how they cut like a bunch of the original Arabic terminology from the book. Between erasing most of the Arabic roots of the Fremen's language and by refusing to place phrases associated with Arab freedom and consciousness raising in the mouths of its ostensible heroes, the movie can't help but feel cowardly and apologetic in the way it translates Herbert's influences in a story whose coding leads distinctly to a tale of Arab and Middle Eastern struggle against colonial powers. And he's kind of referring to like specific phrases connected with Algerian freedom fighters that are in the book and are not referred to in the movie.
The word apologetic really sticks out for me there. It's like that kind of tentativeness where it's like, not only would it be more like true to the original text and more respectful almost of the influences and of the real struggles that you're referring to, but it would make it stronger, you know, it would make it more as a story, more like muscular or something, because there's always that thing in your mind when you're watching it, obviously saying all this whilst completely appreciating, aside from the music, all of the craft elements, but there's that kind of like thing in your mind when you're watching it where you're kind of like, oh, it's not quite there. It's not quite, but if you could, oh. And like you say, if it's supposed to be descended from this stuff, it's just baffling, really. I think apologetic is like a really key word there for what it feels like.
I mean, basically, it's like I was saying at the beginning, it is this snake eating its own tail situation, because like it's really almost an unsolvable problem, because you start out with this text that has highly specific references and images that are kind of orientalist but are coming from a very specific political position, and then you bring that round to the present day in this adaptation and they're like trying to sand off the stuff that's kind of racist, but they're also sanding off a lot of the detail. And they're making casting choices that mean that, like, everyone in the foreground is a Westerner and almost all of them are white, even though that's, like, the correct, quote-unquote, politics of the story, right? So it's, like, it's all a fucking mess.
It's so hard to... Yeah. Nobody was
and
ever going to get it right.
The thing that a lot of people, critics, have been talking about, we're just, like, bringing it back to the real-world context, right? Because it's, like, ultimately, the whole conversation we're having about this, the reason why it's so fraught is because the surrounding media, both news media and pop culture, is so unbelievably Islamophobic.
Yeah, exactly.
We are watching like horrific violence play out in massive amounts of straightforward racism toward anyone who's like perceived as Muslim or Middle Eastern. That's the situation you're kind of plopping this story into. It really intensifies the issues, even though there's like so many decisions in this movie that are so kind of intentional to like make it explicitly a story about a bunch of white colonial villains.
Because it's quite kind of monoculture at the moment. Everybody that I know is watching it, and everybody that I know has been talking about it and been reading loads about it and stuff like that, and pretty much everything that I've read or like every opinion that I've heard has been like, it's incredible, but like there's notes, but like how could there not be? Everybody's kind of like acknowledging this thing that, like you say, it's got this kind of snake eating its own tail kind of inevitability about it. It's a funny one.
So to move on from that crucial topic, would you like to talk about any specific characters and performances that you were enjoying before we get started on the technical elements?
Yes. I would like to talk about the Austin Butler of it all.
Yes!
Also, like, previous to this, you know, I saw Elvis. I'd seen pictures of him just looking like just looking like a guy. And I was like, wow, you really ate this up, Austin Butler. Also, I saw somebody saying that he looks more like a Skarsgård brother than the actual Skarsgård brothers. So, like, excellent casting. I just also kept thinking, this is just a stupid thing, but whenever he came on with, like, the bleached out eyebrows and the shaved head and the, like, long, pressed, dark coat, I was just thinking he looked like Billy Corgan from the Smashing Pumpkins.
Well, the whole vibe, because it's this incredible bald goth vibe. Like, they're on this planet that's just all bald goths.
As I've said before, Dune is goth filmmaking. Like, not just the stuff that is on the goth planet, everything else.
Brutalist,
like,
architecture, barely any plants. Although, incredible. One can also, there is such a thing as plant goth, but, you know. I mean, the word that people often use with Villeneuve is sterile, which in previous episodes I've talked about how I don't think Christopher Nolan is a sterile filmmaker, but here it's, like, visually speaking, that's definitely what's up. And it's, you know, it's both his personal taste. I kind of imagine him living in a sort of concrete, very chic bunker in real life. So it's, like, an intentional choice, but it's also kind of his vibe.
Yeah,
Austin Butler is just giving such a fun performance. It's also, like, a really strong argument for the bald wig, because they didn't shave him. They put, like, a cap
wow.
on him. Yeah, it's, like, a big plopped-on rubber thing that covers his eyebrow area and his hair area, because he was filming the bike riders so close to it, so he couldn't shave his eyebrows and head. And it actually is good, because it gives, like, the level of smoothness that you can't really get if there's, like, any stubble or pores or anything. So it's,
yeah,
like,
no,
this really kind of slick vibe. And just the whole design for the Harkonnens is really funny, because it's going back to a very kind of 90s and 2000s era of what if there was, like, a evil BDSM guy. And it's so fun, but it's also, with a very few exceptions, almost laughable in its kind of lack of threateningness, if you see what I mean. Because in the first movie, there is this incredibly terrifying singular image that only appears in, I think, one scene, which I find incredibly disturbing as a body horror thing, which is in the Baron Harkonnen's house. He has this kind of giant spider creature that's in, like, a spider gimp suit. And I don't know if they say this in the text of the film, but I believe the implication is that this is the wife of a character he's been manipulating and torturing, and he has had this woman, like, surgically altered into this mute spider creature, which is, like, completely horrifying levels of body horror, really disturbing. Whereas some of the other stuff with the Harkonnens, although it's enjoyable, it's just kind of, it's like a very high octane, expensive and glossy version of something that's kind of stupid, which is, like, what if there was, like, a really fat guy who was a horrible perv, which is incredibly basic and lazy storytelling.
Yeah.
Or what if there were, like, a bunch of sadists who wore black rubber all the time? And it's just like, well, okay, I'll accept this is a genre convention, but it's like, come on now. Much as I love Austin Butler and his little squad of sort of, like, bald, sexy torchbearers or whatever,
all the bald, freaked out looking people, like, genderless, boob tube wearing freaks. I love them all. They're my family.
It's very fun. They're the horror version of many a music video from a certain era.
Yeah, and I fucking lapped that shit up. Like, I loved it. I was like, yes. But yeah, it's, like, a kind of extremely expensive, well done, beautiful, gorgeous, perfect version of that. Like, so it's just like, yes.
And once you get that extra context, I think it really adds to Dave Bautista's role, because, I mean, anyone with any taste loves Dave Bautista. Amazing character actor. And he's also, like, spoken so warmly about the idea that, like, Denis Villeneuve was one of his earliest champions and being like, you are actually a good actor, and giving him good roles, which is always really sweet to hear. But he plays the sort of fail son Harkonnen, where he is the nephew of the Baron, the other nephew of the Baron. And he's kind of put in charge in the first movie and then is, like, failing to control Arrakis in the second film, because you've got Timothée Chalamet and his band of heroic guerrilla warriors are, like, constantly sabotaging all of their floating army, whatever stuff. But in this one, you see that because he is this sort of tough guy soldier who's not necessarily a very good strategist, it's like, well, of course you fucking suck. Because you don't have the correct skill set to be succeeding in this scenario, which is winning a guerrilla war, something no one can ever do, because people just keep fucking popping up out of the stand. That's how it works. And also, you don't have the correct personality to gel with your sadistic, foul uncle. Whereas Austin Butler's Fade Rautha is perfect, because he's just this absolute out-and-out villain monster like his uncle. And there's this very fun moment, which, as everyone on social media will now know, Austin Butler improvised, which is kissing his uncle on the mouth. could not be more of a stereotype of this kind of character. They always put in a little blob of, a little touch of like weird incesty homoerotic vibes, classic material, brilliant. But if it works, it works.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, it's a classic for a reason, I think. My favourite bit just in general was the bit on the like monochrome planet. I never thought I'd say the phrase, every time Austin Butler was on screen, I wanted to stand and applaud. But that's just the way things are now.
I think we're going to change our tune because he's already kind of shaping himself up to be, I guess his public image is like, what if I was a serious dramatic actor from the 70s, but like not scary and distasteful is his vibe. Because yeah, the roles he's choosing are like really smart. He's very keen to present himself as a serious actor while not having a sort of abusive sort of image, which is like unfortunately kind of attached to like a lot of these method guys in the 70s. Yeah, I mean, he's being very conscious about this stuff, and it's been a very fun and eye-opening press tour.
I think what he did was he saw the Robert Pattinson interview where Robert Pattinson said, no method actor is ever method acting a nice guy. I think that he took that to heart.
Yeah, because he got overtaken by the ghost of Elvis for like 2 to 3 years. And now he's sort of saying in interviews, it's like, just to be clear, when I was playing Fade Rotha, I was only being Fade for like 20% of the time on set. And the rest of the time I would really try to like talk normal stuff. Just really funny.
Adorable.
But I think adorable. That's a really good way to segue into the technical side of things, which is, of course, enthralling. Yeah. The black and white planet where the Harkonnens come from, that was filmed using an infrared camera. So it's like when you see literally a ring camera, like a CCTV camera that has perfect night vision, that's the style of black and white they use. And that's fascinating to me because the vast majority of black and white filming now is just normal digital filming that is then corrected afterwards, which often is used to try and emulate stuff from the 30s and 40s and looks completely different. It looks like shit because that's not how lighting works. Whereas this intentionally gives you something you've never seen before and it's like, that's fucking great.
That's really cool to hear because I did think, how did they do this? Because it was clearly like digital and non-film. I also really liked how in certain shots there would be a tiny, tiny bit of colour in somebody's face or like, I thought that was just like so smart to be like, look, this isn't just shot in black and white.
It's like, this is how the sun is on this alien planet.
This is just how it fucking looks. It's like, I know that you've seen Maestro this year. I know that you've seen Oppenheimer this year and you're used to films being sometimes in black and white. But this isn't what we're doing here, baby. That kind of thing was like, this is taking it up a notch for me. Like, this is really technical elements and craft on like a deep world building scale.
Yeah. I mean, the way they talk about the filming in the desert is just so funny because it's just, so they filmed a lot of it in Jordan and Abu Dhabi, which once again, where is the film set?
Yeah, who can say?
The kind of interviews I've read with Villeneuve where he talks about finding the right texture and colour of sand and like him and his like production designer and the cinematographer Greg Fraser, obviously an icon, carrying around jars of sand to get like the right colour of sand and like to know what it was meant to look like. They didn't use blue screens for exterior shots, which like, of course they didn't, but like pointing out very accurately that when you have like a giant blue screen in the middle of the desert, it's going to fucking reflect blue. And he's like, well, we can't have that. So they had, you know, they did VFX in other ways, but it's like obviously a very VFX heavy film, but his rule as a director was anything the actors touch or interact with has to be a real prop, which is a good rule that obviously should be followed by all filmmakers who have that kind of budget available. And during the scenes where they have like the ornithopters, like the flying helicopter things, they would shoot all the scenes like in real helicopters and have those in the air. So like you have the correct wind patterns and sand getting thrown up. You can get the right sound and perspective. And then they kind of CGI a fictional ornithopter over the top, which is like, yeah, fucking great. And the budget for this film was like under 200 million.
What?
Yes. The budget was 190 million.
That's insane.
Because he is far better organized and better at time management and like money management.
You know who would appreciate that? Christopher Nolan.
Yeah,
he
those guys,
project
fucking
managers.
Pals, organized guys. And I'm sure they got like a bunch of incredibly evil tax breaks from like Jordan or whatever. This included, they had a 3-month second unit photography squad who were called like the Worm Team or something, whose job was just to film sandworm exterior stuff during, they had like an hour long period each day when they could film it, because you could only film like at dusk and dawn, because during the day it's too hot and like the cameras melt and everyone gets heat stroke.
And so everybody spent, knows like, that Arrakis looks beautiful when the sun's coming down.
Yes, exactly. So they just spent like 3 fucking months filming for like 1 hour a day and then like striking the camp again. So, like,
also,
just...
can you imagine how good like the crew hoodies or t-shirts would have been for those guys? Like Dune.
The worm team.
Dune 2. Worm team.
Just so good. And yeah, like it's so kind of intense. And just to think about the amount of kind of money that is squandered on other projects, because I think the natural assumption just as a casual viewer is like the reason why stuff looks bad is because it's like bad CGI and stuff, but then you don't think about like, well, maybe building a bunch of props isn't more expensive. It's just to do with how the labor is distributed and how much you respect the designers. Yeah, so it's like it looks gorgeous. It's got this combination of digital and film, and it feels just texturally really great. And like there's obviously the situation with the sense of size and scale, which is something almost everyone mentions after watching the film, because there's so many awe-inspiring shots that are like, what if something was really big? And it's like, actually, yes, that's always impressive. That's the reason why people build cathedrals, because it's very impressive when something's big. And then you think about like God. And in this, apparently the inspiration that like the cinematographer Greg Fraser took was from photos of Australian and South American miners alongside big giant machinery. Sure.
Yeah.
Fair enough. That.
Yeah.
That's how big the worm is, or the big spaceships and stuff. And it's always very cool in these movies when a really enormous spaceship comes along.
Always really cool. And then you realize how big it is. Also really love when you see on the kind of monochrome planet and you see all the kind of like Nazi-ish formations of loads and loads of groups of people like in grids. And then you zoom out and then there's even more of them. And it's like,
yeah. I also love when the Harkonnen troops are kind of floating in their kind of semi-gravity armor down off stuff. It's just such a cool, arresting image.
Yeah.
Because all of the fighting with like the Fremen and stuff is always much more kind of traditional hand-to-hand, really well shot, cool action. And then you have these occasional images that are like, no other film has this type of like cool sci-fi image.
Yeah. The floating stuff and the talking about the kind of Fremen action, that kind of hand-to-hand stuff, the kind of final, and this is going into spoilers, the final fight between Austin Butler and Timothy Chalamet is also really exciting, I think, because of the contrast, because everything else has been, even the kind of Fremen fighting has been on like a massive scale. There's another amazing shot where Paul Atreides is like worming his way through like all these gathered Fremen people. And it's like shot from above and it just looks like so huge and amazing. But because this fight is like a, such a smaller scale, and because also Paul has just found out that they're actually cousins, the sense of it both coming down to what it is, which is like a, an inter-family feud for all these like freak eugenics bred
Well, also,
kids.
Claire, do you know the even sexier subtext of this?
Uh-huh.
Which is that, like, because Paul was meant to be a girl, he was bred to be Feyd Rautha's wife, so they would produce, like, the perfect child.
Woofed.
So well, there's actually, like, a sexual subtext to this.
That is much to consider, and I will be thinking about that next time I see the film. We'll be consulting the AO3, because I'm sure that these people have got a lot to say about that. Now we're talking about Paul being bred to be a girl. Can I just, like, talk for a moment about how... Another thing that really took my breath away was, like, sometimes when they cut to, like, a close-up picture of Timothy Chalamet and you see his perfect curls, it just made me want to take a knee. It was just, it was beautiful. And thinking about how his beautiful feminine curls and thinking about how he's on this dry-ass planet, he's got no access to conditioner, and yet his hair is so bountiful. That's eugenics.
The two messages you've got from this movie are actually eugenics will lead to a perfect human and you should definitely admire someone who's like really handsome and charismatic, which is definitely the mission Denis Villeneuve and Frank Herbert definitely wanted
they
you to
really
get from
wanted
this.
Me to get this.
Like, wow, he really is like really well bred.
Really
it's like,
really
no,
beautiful.
That isn't what we wanted. It's like when you're watching Game of Thrones and you're like, well, this is really a great show about like who's the winner.
I'd like to just clarify for the listeners that I do not really believe that you just One thing also that I want to say about Timothy Chalamet's performance, which I thought was made it enjoyable. And I generally think, you know, he's an archetype, you know, he's supposed to be this like colonial evil prince, really. But one thing that I really enjoyed was, especially in like the first like 45 minutes or so of the film, that you really believe that he's doing all this to impress a girl. The slice of Timothée Chalamet that's like a fuckboy, is like really, really playing up to this like, oh yeah, sure, babe, I just want to be equal to you, babe. I just want to like learn your language and the ways of your people. Like, I don't want to be like the oppressor. No, oh babe, don't say that. I just want to be the same as you. And it's like very, very believable.
Yes.
And it's both funny and also like even more pathetic and tragic. The reason why like this holy war is happening is because of this fucking little shit, you know? It was just a little thing that really, I thought, tied in well with it.
Yeah, I mean, I have no particular desire to rewatch this like soon, but I would be quite interested at some point to watch the two films back to back, because it's so clear that this movie enriches so much of the stuff that happens in the first film. Because the first film kind of introduces this scene with Oscar Isaac, who plays Paul Atreides' dad, where he is basically like, you don't actually need to be in power for me to be proud of you. Like, I will be proud of you just because you're my son. And the whole point of all of our duty as like feudal leaders is you should only lead if you feel like you're called to lead, which obviously in itself is like a bullshit thing, but the movie really does set up his father, Leto Atreides, as this very kind of honourable figure who is within this system but is less malevolent than the others, and is, of course, that's why he, like, gets killed off in the first act, much like the dad from the first season of Game of Thrones, you know, the Sean Bean character, and that kind of precipitates Paul's thirst for revenge. But it's like, if you were, like, respecting your father's wishes, you'd understand that he'd probably prefer for you to find a moral and comfortable way to live than to start this war that's going to kill billions of people. But then also, because like Jessica and Leto had this incredibly passionate love, you can kind of see in this film, you're like, yeah, Jessica's kind of been driven mad by the fact that her lover is being killed in this horribly violent way, and she's lost the comfortable life that she used to have, and that set her on this path. And before he died, Leto did say, like, do whatever you can to protect our son using your Bene Gesserit training. And that is what she does. Yeah. And it's very bad.
Yeah.
She's like, the best way to protect my son is to have him lead a holy war. And that's how you end up in this situation.
Yeah. There's so many different strands of what happens when somebody who is essentially has all this power and privilege gets a little inkling in their mind about something.
You can tell something's really well written when there is this sense of sort of inexorable inevitability based on a bunch of different moving parts to do with different people's motives and their personalities is going to lead toward this terrible thing you can't help happening. And that kind of ties into the idea of prophecy and inevitability and the way that people are intentionally manipulating the prophecy and the narrative. One of the other articles that Roxana Hadidi wrote at Vulture was about Chani's characterization, and I thought that was really interesting because it's like, in the book, the romance happens much more suddenly almost, because like the book takes place over a longer period. There's a long period of time of several years when Paul and Jessica are in the desert with the Fremen. She actually gives birth during the book, and the kid is already like a young child by the end of the story. So like one of the major changes that Denis Villeneuve and John Spates made was having the kid not be born in this narrative. You only see her during like a sort of dream sequence as Anya Taylor-Joy. But with Chani in the original story, she is loyal to Paul, they're a united front, and the idea of her being kind of an anti-religious skeptic was sort of way accentuated in the movie. And I don't know if I'm into the idea. Like, Roxana Hadidi certainly wasn't into that idea, but like, she has a lot more like deep thoughts about the books and that sort of thing, which I don't. But the fact that like the way they present the Fremen viewpoints are the two kind of main people are the comedic religious extremist, you know, inspiring all these memes about him, like believing that anything Paul does means that he's the Lisan al-Ghaib, which is funny and is also like a pretty accurate way of like how people believe when they believe a conspiracy theory or like a religious message, they will find anything to shape their worldview. But then you have the character who is like got the American accent and is acting like a quote-unquote normal American young person, which is Chani. And she's the one who is more skeptical and has a more kind of politically accessible viewpoint for mainstream viewers, which is, I want my people to be free, but I don't want to do stuff that's too bad. The way you've like framed that in the religious world building of the story is like very different from the idea of her being someone who buys into her partner being the Messiah earlier on in the story. Yeah. And then like this film ends after this amazing duel. The film ends with her leaving him, disapproving of his rise to power. Because like the final scenes of the movie, which obviously we've spoiled already a bit with the duel, but like he has this duel with Feyd Rautha because Feyd Rautha is the representative of Christopher Walken, the Emperor. And after winning that duel, Paul claims the throne as Emperor and then claims Princess Irulan Florence Pugh as his wife. So he will, in the future, in theory, have Irulan as his wife and then Chani as his concubine. That ending... it's different. It's very different politically for Chani because she now this kind of oppositional force rather than being like all in. Now we've kind of talked about the whole plot. It really makes me want to talk about what's going to happen in the next film. But obviously that's spoilers. So like, I guess just Google Dune Messiah. The series goes to like some absurd situations. So there's like, you know, you get four books in. Paul's son is 3,500 years old and he's half worm. And he's has like a love triangle with a clone of Jason Momoa's character. So it's if they kept making these, Jason Momoa's character has a clone in every single book, including the famously terrible ones that were written by Frank Herbert's son. And I fucking love that. And like Jason Momoa is so good in that role in the first movie. So it's like, that would be amazing.
I rewatched, as many people probably did, I rewatched Dune with my friend Sophie when I was just on holiday in New York. Slight brag there. Sophie during it said that Jason Momoa, you know, like how usually how people have iPhone face? Jason Momoa has bootcut jeans body. Which I agree. It's like Jason Momoa, amazing performance. He's great in it, but bootcut jeans body.
He kind of ought to be like on a dirt bike or a surfboard at any given moment. Which is very much the vibe that he is intentionally giving out into the world. Like I'm sure he could make other decisions, but he's like, I have a look. It's highly specific, and that's also my personality.
Yeah. And you know, he's the one playing a guy called Duncan Idaho. So like it's fair enough.
It's the greatest name of all time. This is one of the reasons why, like, all the chat about the language in this movie being totally innate to the universe and having no roots is, like, so absurd. Because it's like, they're all named fucking Paul and Jessica. Like, we know where those names come from. And it's, like, Europe and the Bible. Okay, so come on now. Yeah. Actually, before we wrap up, I just want to shout out Christopher Walken because he's just wonderful in this.
I really enjoyed him.
Really minor elder statesman actor role as the Emperor. And it's like, whenever he's on screen, he just has this wonderfully, like, sincere energy. Like, obviously, he's like a despot, but the way that they kind of characterize him is so radically different from the more obviously evil Harkonnen people is so good because it's like he's manipulating everything behind the scenes, but you're like, oh, it's just this grandpa. That's kind of how, like, the wheels of power work.
Yeah, it's really good. And I really loved him. Florence Pugh, who is another big Clebidos fave, extremely good and beautiful in this. And Charlotte Rampling, goth queen. I love the trio of them. It's like, sure, yeah, I can get you as a family that are, you know, the trio that are in power. Like, I get it.
Yeah, you've got the normal family unit, which is like aging emperor, very smart 20-something princess, and manipulative sex nun. Yes. A role that Charlotte Rampling has probably played 5 to 10 times.
And I have lapped it up every single time.
But yeah, Christopher Walken, just to cap off the episode, I just loved him. And then it's like the final act is, you know, he hands over the emperorship to Paul. And Paul tells the rest of the ruling houses that he's going to be emperor. They're naturally like, who are you? And he ends the movie by saying, send them to paradise. So he is fully launching the holy war, which will lead into, in theory, a third movie, which everyone involved definitely wants to make, but won't happen for a while because there is a 12-year time jump between the stories. So it's you've got a long period for them to like germinate. And also Denis Villeneuve was like, I've been filming in the sand for several years now and I'd like to be indoors.
I am like the Fremen, very thirsty. Yeah. Very hot.
So I think we've covered all of our Dune thoughts. Loved talking about this movie. I imagine I will see it in a few months again once it's on home release and my Dune pal gets to watch it because he doesn't like going to the movies. So that'll be good. And coming up, we have some very fun episodes. I think, are you and I going to do a recap of the Glasgow Film Festival?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, so we've got that coming up. So my next episode with Stefan is going to be sometime in the next few weeks. It's on the Australian comedy drama Upright, which was a listener request. I'm really looking forward to this. It looks great. It is about Tim Minchin as a struggling musician. I've not started watching yet, but like signs point to it being cool. And then after that, Claire and I are going to do the Joe Wright film Hannah,
which I fucking
love. I have seen that movie 4 or 5 times.
Wow. That's quite unusual for you. I'd say that that's more unusual than me watching a film 12 times.
Yeah, I'm not even sure why. Because I love that movie, but it's like, usually when I've seen a film that many times, it's one of my favorite films of all time. So it's like Master and Commander. Uh-huh. But I think because this came out in 2011, I've had like a long period to watch it, and probably a couple of occasions where I've grabbed someone and been like, you have to see this movie.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's like one of Saoirse Ronan's first really big roles. And it's like an indie action thriller with Saoirse Ronan and Kate Blanchett and Eric Bana in what I think might be Eric Bana's best role, because I think there's a lot of movies where he is an actively bad actor. It's like a spy thriller with a teen girl protagonist, and it's got incredible costumes, and the entire soundtrack is an original album by the Chemical Brothers.
Oh,
and it's really good. That soundtrack is a banger. And yeah, so Hannah, we're going to watch that in a while, and also the sitcom Upright. And before that, as I said, recap of the Glasgow Film Festival, where you and I are collectively watching like 100 movies.
We're in the middle of it right now.
Yeah, so you can find me, as always, Letterboxd, Hello Taylor, Gavia at Blue Sky. Claire, where can we find you?
Yeah, you can find me on Letterboxd at Claire Biddles, which is just my name. And you can find me on Twitter and Blue Sky at Ms. Claire Biddles, which is my name with MS at the beginning.
All right, lovely. And don't forget to check out our episode from 2021 on the first Dune movie. All right, see you all soon. Bye-bye.